This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It's all about living your best life.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Wonderful to have you with us on another episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. What toys do our children actually need? Not want, need. We were speaking to a parenting expert, Pascal, from Moments of Parenting. She was on hand to outline what is useful for their development, for their education, for relationships and bonding. And crucially, the toys that you can get rid of or perhaps never even welcome over the threshold. And from little ones to not so little ones, how do you talk to your child about puberty? It's a conversation no parent really looks forward to, but it's so important they get good information from the right resources. Hanan from the Family Hub was on hand after she witnessed a really distraught young woman in her school and realised that so many people are avoiding this topic of conversation. And in light of the horrendous scenes at the Denmark-Finland game, would you know what to do if someone required CPR? Rebecca Smith from Safe Hands was on hand to offer up some advice and give us a mini lesson. And words of affirmation. Maybe your house is covered in words telling you how confident and capable you are. Maybe it's something we should be doing more for ourselves, but also for our children. We had the head of lower school at Dwight School, Linda Vassal, on hand with the 9 affirmations we should be saying to our kids.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Every day is a school day, although some seem to deliver more information more effectively than others. And we're asking you today, how did you learn about puberty? Was it through school? Was it through parents? Our Instagram poll right now says 33% of you learnt from mum or dad, 77% from somewhere else. So this could be friends, the internet, if you're young enough. Mine was your Judy Blume books, your Just 17s, Whispers in the Playground. And then I think mum and dad tried to have a conversation with me when it was probably a bit too late. And joining us now, we've got Abir Altamini. She's a mum of a teenager. So Abir, you're me in a few years' time. So I'm here to pick your brains and hear what I've got to kind of look forward to on the parenting front. How old is your daughter?
She's 14, and let me tell you, Helen, there's going to be a lot of eye rolling.
Oh, no, I already get it. I've already got major attitude from a six-year-old. It can't get much worse. Now, Abir, take yourself back to your teens and even tweens. What were you taught by your parents about puberty?
I'm the one who brought it up with my mother when I was 10 years old, because my best friend had an older sister. And so her older sister would talk about it with us. And I had so many questions. I was very shy. But I went home and I asked my mother, and she sat me down and had the talk with me. But I had initiated it because I think she thought I was too young. But she didn't brush it off. She actually answered each and every question that I had.
That's amazing, because I have to say, I think a lot of the discomfort, embarrassment, 100% comes from the parents. It's us
Of
projecting that on our kids. And often it can be children of, you know, 4 to 14 and even older, who just want some honest answers to questions. Because at the minute, we've got the internet, and that is, of course, an amazing source of information. But it's often too much information, too much conflicting information. And now that you have a teenager yourself, how are you?
I have two, Helen.
You're in the trenches.
I have a 16-year-old.
Please tell me, oh wise one, how are you approaching being a parent and talking about puberty to teens?
Well, it's all trial and error, but because times have changed so much. Growing up in the UAE, I mean, we only had 4 schools, 1 mall. I even remember when McDonald's opened in 1994. I was 14 years old. It was like the highlight for us. Now, there's so many schools. There's so many places they can socialize. You need to just not go in guns blazing when something goes wrong, you know? Mm-hmm. I think the most important thing for us as parents to remember with teenagers is they need guidance. They're young adults. Full of hormones, with a lot of emotions. They're very fragile at this stage of their life, and they just need you to listen to them. So when I feel that there's something going on, or they feel down, I won't be like, what's, I'm totally against helicopter, being a helicopter parent. I give them their space. I tell them, listen, I know something's going on. Whenever you're ready, you can come and talk, we can talk about it. But whenever you're ready. And it actually so far has been working for me really well.
So can I ask you then, when you think about teens currently here in the UAE, for that is where we are, where do you think most of them are getting their information from?
Oh, for sure. It's unfortunately TikTok.
Oh, no. Are you serious?
It's social media. Oh, it's, no. It definitely is social media. It's a different time. It really is. And I give them, like, if I want something to be done at work, if I want something to be done on social media, I involve them. It's very important. I tell them, oh, guys, you know about this more than I do, you know? And I sometimes joke about it. I'm like, but I know more about life than you do.
I think that's really smart, though, because, you know, when we ask our kids to teach us something, you know, it strengthens that bond. It boosts their confidence. And, yeah, you're getting information out of them that you might need to pay someone to get. So happy days indeed. For anyone who is feeling like a level of discomfort about talking to their teens or tweens about puberty, what would be your key bit of advice, Abir?
They definitely should have the talk with them. I mean, as young as 10, 9 and 10 years old, because like you said earlier, Helen, there's a lot of misinformation out there, a lot. And why am I telling you that it needs to be early? Because it's a lot of misinformation, even in the music that we listen to, the shows, the movies. These children have a lot of exposure, and no matter how much you try to, you know, control their social media time, and at the end, they're going to be exposed, whether it's in a friend's house, at school, somewhere. So you should have the talk with them and be completely honest with them. And this is when they're younger, but we need to also, as parents, not forget how we felt as teenagers. Put yourself in your kids' shoes in that certain situation. You know, you have to have the talk with them. You have to be honest with them and be open with them, because they will appreciate that. They will come to you.
I think that moment of discomfort initially is so worth the relationship and the conversations it can lead to. Abir, thank you so, so much for sharing your experiences. Really appreciate lots of you getting in touch on this. So asking you, have you had the talk with your child? If so, how old are the kids? Rahini's been in touch with the teenage boy.
I was really lucky. My husband had the awkward but very important conversation about puberty with him. I know that he used books. I know the school helped. This one was all about him.
Isha's saying, I just want someone to do this for me. She says, I don't think I'm in the right frame of mind to talk to my girl about puberty. I'm still processing what went wrong during my young adult life. Sunil says, I found out through reading the dictionary. Parents tried to talk to me about puberty when I was 19. Too late.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking children's health, parenting and education this afternoon. How did you learn about puberty? Was it school? Was it parents? Was it, in my case, teenage magazines I probably shouldn't have been reading that I'd borrowed from a friend's older sister? Judy Blume books, novels? Let us know. And have you had the talk with the child? Hanan is joining us this afternoon, the founder of The Family Hub. We've had a number of messages and questions coming in on this, including May.
At 10 years old, my mom taking me and my cousins to the bathroom and showing us how to place a pad and what it means and stuff like that. My mom was always very open whenever I asked her about what is happening to my body and what it means and stuff. But otherwise, school did not help with that.
And here's Malak.
I actually missed learning about puberty in school because I went to a Saudi school until 8th grade, and then I went to an American high school. So in Saudi schools, you learn about puberty way later in 12th grade. And in American schools, you learn about puberty way earlier in middle school. So I missed it in both ways. My mom didn't talk to me about it. She talked to me about some aspects of it, but not all of it. I really ended up learning about the majority of it on my own, really, from reading about it, from researching about it on my own. A lot of it was online, so just Googling, researching, from TV. So I would see something on TV and then I would Google it, research it, try to find out more about it. So just kind of trying to navigate it on my own.
So interesting. Google wasn't around when I was 10. TikTok being a source for information, we know it's a great place for dancing, but there are some places on that platform that are for education as well. Is that a common scenario? Because my mind was a little bit blown when Abir said that.
Yeah, TikTok is a number one reference for kids. And unfortunately, that's where they get most of the information, not just from TikTok, but social media as a general rule. When I ask, you know, kids, I've been working for 12 years with teenagers and I have a teenager at home. So I understand that this is their friends are their number one source, because unfortunately, a lot of us as parents find that awkward, that conversation very awkward. And so we don't get to do it. And in a lot of schools, that isn't the norm as well. They do not give the health education priority. So kids miss out on, you know, the educational part of growing up and puberty and so on. So yeah, they do get a lot of the information from their friends and from social media.
Social media can be an amazing resource, though. There's no taking away from it, but there's so much misinformation out there as well. And in some cases, kids who just haven't got access to information at all. You shared a story on social media about a girl you found crying in the school bathroom because she just got a period and she thought she was dying. I mean, this is just absolutely heartbreaking. What was your response?
I was shocked at first. I didn't know what was wrong. And then you know, we had a conversation, we talked, and she was devastated, Helen. She thought something was wrong. And, you know, with her, she thought she was dying. And like when we talked it through, I calmed her down. I told her everything, like scientifically, I told her how to clean herself. Like I gave her the hygiene version as well of everything. And then I started to joke that this is something that's going to be happening, you know, once a month for the rest of your life and you need to get over it. And, you know, and so on. We started to joke about it, but it hit me then that I wasn't the one that was supposed to have that conversation. Mm-hmm. And that was 10 years ago almost. And I was not the one that was supposed to have that conversation. It should have come from an adult that was, you know, not her English teacher. It should have been, you know, someone who has like specialized in that. And from then on, that's where I started to take these courses and I started to teach them to parents so that you can actually support your kids doing this, because it's very important to have these conversations at home.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Family Matters indeed. How did you learn about puberty? Was it school? Was it parents? Was it, are you there? God, it's me, Margaret. Like I'm getting a lot of messages about on my Instagram stories. Have you had the talk with your child about puberty? We've got Hanan with us, the founder of the Family Hub. She's on hand to answer your questions. So please do reach out. Now, here is a Dubai mum who wants to remain anonymous. She says if her teenage sons knew, they would be horrified.
Being a mum of two young men, Just for Boys is a book about growing up. The information was all factual and interesting, nothing inappropriate at all. My sons gave me the typical embarrassed eye roll when I gave it to them, but they have made references about it several times. It also talks a lot about healthy diet, exercising and hygiene. Great book, would recommend it to anyone with preteen and teen boys. It made those discussions easier to explain.
Oh, well, that's hopefully helped out a message that's come in with No Name Hanan saying, do you have any good recommendations for a fairly gentle but factual book about puberty for 9-year-old girls? She's very scientifically minded, something we could read together and then she can later read alone. How useful do you feel like books are when it comes to broaching some of these topics, Hanan?
Very much. They really are, especially since you have so many very good authors that are writing for different age groups. So there are some things that you can read with your kids, some things that you can leave to them. And I mean, I've done it with my own kids and I recommend it all the time. There's a list of books to recommend. Just for Boys is a very good one. So is Just for Girls. So both of them, they work well. For parents to educate yourselves, there is Raising Girls and Raising Boys. Both of them are very, very good. They will take you through the entire cycle. And they also give like the emotional and psychological perspective as well. So both are very good. There's one called Body Safety Education. And Let's Talk Consent, Boundaries. And it's another very good one. And there is one actually that I have with me. I know that the audience can't see us, but we can. Here, it's called Brilliant Questions About Growing Up. This is also very good.
I mean, in total honesty, my kids are a lot younger than this kind of 9, 10 and into the teens age bracket. I'm kind of telling my kids everything, to be honest. Yeah. And this is not through me being like a super like modern, you know, libertarian parent. It's simply because I'm too tired to lie, and I feel like if I lie, I'm going to get caught up in my lies. I just can't be bothered. We have a book called Amazing You, which for younger ones, I really, really like. And it's that kind of question, like, you know, mum, where do babies come from? But it's also got photos of a baby boy, a little boy, and then an adult. So you can see, you know, how the body changes. And it's quite whimsical. It talks about the importance of naming body parts, which I feel like is really, really crucial. And so if anyone's looking for that kind of preschooler age group, it's called Amazing You. Are you familiar with that one, Hanan?
Yes, I am. And actually, anything by Janine Sanders is a wonderful, wonderful suggestion. Her name is Janine Sanders. She has a whole list of things for kids ages 2 and up. And she talks to the little kids. And there are a lot of very nice illustrations that talk about, you know, body safety, privacy, and where do babies come from? Like in a very, because kids at that age, at your kids' age, Helen, all they want is just a quick answer. And then their mind wanders off to the next question. They don't want like any in-depth details at all. So the simpler it is, the more their curiosity will be satisfied. And they're not going to be hounding you with a million questions. And if they do, we're educated enough, and we have so many resources out there to educate ourselves and our kids, so we can just use them and use them wisely.
When it comes to having the conversation, I think this is a really interesting point that's come in on the messenger saying, my daughter's almost 13, started periods at 12. We've always been open about the body and what it does. She was aware of periods from a young age. She turned 10, the wall came up, and she refused to talk about body or puberty. So it was a good job we had talks ahead of that. I now have to talk about it in the hope she's taking it all in. My mum was always open with my sister and I, so it's only natural to be the same with my daughter. That's very much echoing how I feel, and I think I'm sure your reason are more pure than mine are, which is kind of sheer inability to, you know, tell the same lie twice.
Helen, you're an amazing mom.
Thank you. Yeah. But I think that the point there about when to have the conversation is a really, really crucial one. How do you know when's the right time, and how can you do it in a way that isn't sitting your child down at the kitchen table and having one of those conversations where they start backing away and going, mum and dad are being weird?
You know, all the movies, they have the let's have the talk and the birds and the bees and all that. We need to stop that at all. That's not how it goes. We start at the age of around 9, give or take. And it also depends on the maturity of your child. So where is your child? I mean, you don't want to scare them, but you also want to give them enough knowledge to empower them, right? And it's about that empowerment and the respect that they show for their bodies and for other people's bodies and the changes that they go through. Why do we start at the age of 9? It's because some people have early growth spurts, and that's when it starts to kick in. A lot of kids get bullied when they grow up older than the others, and a lot of kids get a huge attack of low self-esteem when they look different than the rest of their peers, especially that during that age of like 9 to 14 is the age when the kids are very self-conscious about anything they do. So it's very important for us as their families and their parents to give them that knowledge that they know that you and the others, nobody is different. You're just mm-hmm. growing up and at different speeds. Mm-hmm. So we start around at the age of 9, and we break it up into small parts. It's not just one sit down and that's it. And, you know, give them a quiz later. That's not how we do it. We just give them in small bits and pieces and be open for the fact that they might shut down. They might not want to have that conversation. We feel awkward. They feel awkward. That's okay. Completely okay and completely justified. But keep talking. Don't stop. And even if they put the wall up, because that's the age, they will put walls up, but they're also going to find like little areas to have you, I mean, get into the, like break that wall and seep in somehow.
Thank you, so, Hanan. Hanan's joining us this afternoon. She's the founder of the Family Hub. A really interesting message here from Shailene saying, our school shied away from discussions about puberty, even though it was part of the curriculum. They kind of breezed through it. Our teacher wasn't equipped. You could tell it made her uncomfortable.
Family Matters
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We've got Hanan joining us. She's the founder of The Family Hub. As we discuss, how do you talk to your kids about puberty? When and where and how do you do it? And I think this is such an interesting point from Shalene that came in, Hanan, because you are both an educator, a parent, of course, and you have The Family Hub. Shalene's saying our school shied away from discussions about puberty, even though it was part of the curriculum. They kind of breezed through it. Our teacher wasn't equipped with answers either, and you could tell the subject made her uncomfortable. Talk to us about schools and the best, the optimum delivery of this kind of information.
Yeah, schools need to give health education to kids at different intervals. So around grade 5 and 6, and then again at around grades 8 and 9, give or take. Just because these are the two turning points for children, and it's so important for the kids to get that idea and to understand why certain things are happening and understand how they're happening and how that impacts them. Because when they don't understand it scientifically and understand that this is something that happens to everybody, their self-esteem takes a huge hit, mm-hmm. and a huge dip. And schools cannot do it alone. Parents cannot do it alone. We need to do it together, all of us, in schools and answer their questions. Even if their questions are goofy or they're silly or there are some alpha boys there that want to show off that, you know, they have some piece of, you know, knowledge, mm-hmm. still look them in the eye and answer their questions, because that's all they want at the end of the day.
And I think what, unfortunately, a lot of shame comes from changing bodies, and that should never be the case. So the more information we can give, the better. And I'm not saying the earlier it needs to be age appropriate, but certainly to be the one to answer their questions. We just need to put on our own kind of grown-up pants and put our own embarrassment aside. Lots of you getting in touch on this. This is Lulu.
I learned about it all by myself, to be honest. My mom was too busy at work. And of course, I wouldn't talk about the subject with my dad, so I had to learn about it all by myself. It was a bit tough. I had a lot of questions. When I had some doubts, I used to go to her.
And Suman here, mum of two girls who are about to hit puberty. So where are they getting their information from?
They asked me, when do girls normally get their periods? My other daughter piped up and said that she saw on TikTok that it could be anywhere between 9 to 13 years old. So there's a lot of information they have access to without me knowing that that was a topic of conversation on those platforms. Also, I think culturally, I'm from India. We grew up quite in a conservative place, so we didn't have parents that talked about puberty to us in that sense. So it was not a topic that was openly discussed. We were kind of told it at school. I'm quite prepared to talk to them about it, and I have raised it up with my kids. There is so much information out there, I think, that they have access to, that it's quite important to get in quite early and give them the right information, so they're not getting half-baked information from either their peers or from the internet as such.
The internet as such, a very clever way of saying that, something that we know is a problem for a lot of teens and where they're getting the information about puberty and relationships as well. And then if anyone needs your expert advice, and this really is an area that you're really passionate about, if they need some guidance through this, what's the best way of getting in touch with you?
On Instagram, it's @thefamilyhub_Hanan, H-A-N-A-N.
Thank you for having me, as always. And I think these kind of conversations, you know, no one looks forward to sitting down and having a chat about, you know, periods and changing bodies, but it's something we have responsibility to do as parents. And there are people out there who can help us do that if we need it. So I hope that has helped someone this afternoon. And as Hanan says, she's got some great book recommendations, which can be brilliant for starting that conversation.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking toys this afternoon, the ones we should be having in our home, the ones that we can gleefully ditch or swerve around in the toy aisle. So let me know this afternoon, what toys did you play with growing up? Have any stood the test of time? Are your kids playing with them now? And what do your children like playing? For us, I have very fond memories of Sylvanian families. As you probably know by now, I'm all about the Lego. Pass that on to the kids. But there were a few trends along the way. Some Cabbage Patch Kids. I never succumbed to the Tamagotchi phase. Let us know. 4001. Use the app. or give us a call if you need any advice on basically putting together some ideal toys, an ideal play space for your kids. Please do get in touch as well, because joining us today, we've got Pascal. She's the founder of Moments of P, a mindfulness practitioner when it comes to all things parenting. She had a fast-paced life working at Google, but decided she wanted to improve mental health, well-being, and create some balance at home. So she's now a certified co-active and parenting coach, and she's also relation coaching and looks at mindfulness and well-being. So she's on the hand to tell us that the toys our kids perhaps do need and should be encouraged to play with, and those that we can, yeah, this get rid of. Another question, Pascal, how do we get rid of them? We'll be addressing that too. Thank you so much for being with us. Can I ask you to get started? Why does it matter what toys we buy for our children and that they interact with?
Thank you for having me, Helen. Well, I think why it really matters is because toys play is the majority of the life of these children, and it is our way to pass on our values to them. So if we choose carefully, if we start from when they're young, this is how we prepare them to be the adult that we want them, you know, hope for them to be. So carefully choosing what we put in their environment for them to be using is the number one thing we should be, you know, aiming to do.
How do toys then affect their behavior and their personality? When we think about influences of peers, of advertising, of, you know, even what they're watching on TV, with what they're, you know, they're using with their hands, how can that ultimately impact who they can become?
It definitely can, because, you know, this is what they're spending their time doing. Now, I'm not saying playing with something can make them become, you know, bad human beings. But if we replace all of that time spent, you know, with maybe useless toys or something that is not empowering them and helping them grow in the right ways, why not use all of that time with things that can, you know, let's say, empower them to be more mindful, more emotionally intelligent, more creative, more independent. So we're really filling up their day, their time. So why not choose the best that we can provide?
And when we say best, we're certainly not about going out and spending all your money and thinking about most expensive things. It's things that tick the boxes in terms of child development, education, yeah, relationships as well. I was thinking about you this morning, actually, as I was just about to take the kids to school, because I knew we were having this discussion about the things that kids should and perhaps shouldn't have at home. And so my daughter is 4, and they had a quick play just before we got the bags to go to school. I had to put it on my Instagram, and I've been a bit overwhelmed by people's response, to be honest, because it was basically my 4-year-old sat there and we'd made these Lego beds. So they love the, like, making kind of home environments for their Lego people. So I'd made these beds, and she said, Mummy, the princesses are going to bed now because they've got the virus, but Belle isn't going because she's had the injection. In my mind, I was like, what? And I was like, okay, all right, sweetheart, that's great, great. And it kind of freaked me out a bit because, you know, this has become part of their day-to-day conversation. This is very much what they're used to. My daughter's never been to school without a teacher wearing a mask. But I've honestly been thinking about it a lot, that this is obviously how she's been making sense of living, yeah, as a 4-year-old in a pandemic. And if her acting out with her little princess Legos about them being in bed with COVID or one of them having the injection, it's not the worst way to try and make sense of it, I guess. What's your take?
Not at all. Actually, it's absolutely healthy. It's the best way. You know, this is how children process big things, what happens to them. I mean, yes, today it's the pandemic and, you know, the vaccines and all of that. And they bring it home and they process it. And using, you know, characters and dolls, and we'll talk about that, is, you know, a healthy way. And we've done that when we were young. I mean, who here hasn't played, you know, teacher at home or doctor or dentist, you know, after you've had a visit to the doctor or the dentist and you had to get your shot or, you know, a cleaning that you didn't like, and you go home and you take your dolls or your characters and you pretend to be the doctor or, you know, to be the teacher because you want to process this, you know, scenario that has happened. So absolutely healthy. Yeah, it's scary for us. I completely get you. When I hear these things, I'm like, what's going on in this world? But it's their healthy way of processing it.
Okay, thank you, Pascal. I appreciate it. But lots of messages coming in on the toys that we played with as a child. Gwen saying loved reading comic books, was never really interested in toys. Reem saying toys are so expensive, especially here. Keen to hear the list. It's hard to get away from toys and they're all over the internet. Ryan's toy review on YouTube. Those videos are the bane of my life. Reem, I'm with you. Do not get me started on Roma and Dan. Do not get me started.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking toys this afternoon. So what did you grow up playing with? Has anything stood the test of time? And what is a big hit in your household? Julie's been in touch, Pascal, saying a recent survey from the UK and States showed that each child on average has 150 toys. And I was like, that seems like a lot. And then I was running through my head going, I don't know. We've had a few Happy Meals in our time. That really doesn't surprise me. We're going to be talking about the toys that your child does need. And I feel like the word need is really interesting in, as opposed to the word want. Can you give us your list of things that can really benefit a child and their development?
Definitely, yes. Just before I give you the list, I want to comment on this point of need. The fact that this is called that they need is because it's the only things that they actually need. Everything else is what they would want. So first of all, ahead of everything, the playing in nature, playing outside, just using their imagination and what's already available is like number zero. It's above all. This is what they actually really need. Everything else is extra. It's what we can provide indoors in our homes. So I'll go ahead. Number one is blocks, any type of blocks. It could be wooden blocks, plastic blocks, magnetic blocks, anything that the child will use to build something, to build the world that they want, the world that they imagine, and use it in a multitude of ways. So it's not to build something, you know, to match a picture, but to just imagine and build whatever they want.
Okay, so as you say, sometimes it might be building towards something in particular in from their imagination, but it's really about open-ended play. So using those blocks that can be, you know, houses or a stable or a bedroom or a circus or whatever that might be.
Exactly. And the world that they want, it could be copying something real like roads and schools, or it could be just imagining something like a fantasy world of their own.
So who is going to be living in this fantasy world? Because next on your list, you've got a doll or some characters.
Exactly. So a doll or any type of character, it could be a very simple symbol of another human being. So it doesn't have to be a certain brand or to look like a certain way. Actually, the simplest it is, the better. It's really a character for the child to take care of, to practice what, you know, the real life skills are. Just like you were saying with your daughter, she was practicing, you know, hospital beds and nurses and, you know, school. Keep it very simple. A set of characters could even be like these wooden pegs that you can paint or just leave blank. It also can include animals, just made up family figures.
Okay. We've had a message from Ryan saying the only thing my son wants to play with is a ball. And that is number three on your list. Obviously, the possibilities are endless. It's, you know, it's kicking, it's bouncing, it's passing, it's coordination, a make believe as well. So I think that's a brilliant addition to any list. Number four is art supplies, which, I mean, I could spend a merry fortune on. What would you consider to be essentials when it comes to getting a bit messy at home?
Well, the essentials are really just paper and paint. That's all you really, really need. Now, whatever you can add, you want to add brushes or sponges, or you want to use something like, you know, sticks that you have at home, that's completely fine. The more they are sensory rich, the better. That's why paint is more recommended than actual markers. And they can last longer too.
Now, scarves and dressing up is next on the list. And is this a kind of a substitute to a lot of the, I mean, and we have a number of them, the kind of highly flammable, bulky princess dresses that all girls, no matter how much you think they're going to be tomboys and they're going to wear neutrals, they hit around the age of three and it's all pink, purple and princesses. Why scarves and dressing up things over those kind of store-bought princess dresses?
Well, exactly like you said, these dresses are first huge. They need a lot of storage space in your home. And they don't last long. You know, like the next movie will come up and the next princess will come up and they're going to want the next dress. Scarves or just simple fabrics, they can be reimagined, you know, over and over again. They encourage the creativity of the child to make something up. You know, you can use a white fabric to make a doctor's gown, or you can make it into a princess, like a, you know, bride princess dress. It's really being encouraging them to be creative, saving on your storage space, on your wallet. You know, we do get princess dresses mostly as gifts, you know, Christmas, birthdays, etc. What I encourage my kids to do after a little bit of time is to sell them and use the money to get something else so that we avoid the bulky storage.
Okay. Number six on your list is anything that encourages large movements of the body, so those gross motor skills. This sounds like it's going to take up a lot of space. What are some of the things you're talking about, mm-hmm. and how, if we are living in a smaller apartment or haven't got a garden, how can that work?
It can simply be your mattress. It can be your sofa cushions thrown on the floor. It can be a little beam that they can, you know, practice balancing on, or just like get a string and, you know, put it on the floor from point A to point B and they can practice. It doesn't have to take much space. Now, if you have the luxury of having space, adding swings, adding slides is wonderful. You can even add a swing indoor that doesn't take much space. You know, you can just make a little bit of room when they want to use it. And also make use of your local parks, you know, to just give them the chance to exercise their gross motor skills. The kids absolutely need this.
Yes, there's energy. Energy to be run off. Number seven on your list, Pascal, is vehicles, trains, cars and trucks. What do they bring to a children's life when it comes to play?
Well, again, it's really a symbol of what we actually do. I mean, I drive a car, you drive a car. Why shouldn't all girls have a little car to, you know, drive around with? They would just enjoy driving like their parents, but in their own world. So, like I said, definitely not just for boys, but trains, cars, trucks. It's a real part of our world that they see every day. So giving them that will just let them, you know, use their imagination and, play in their own little worlds.
You've also got books, which I need absolutely no convincing of at all. But what you say it's about having good books. What in your definition would be a book that you could, you know, deserves to have a spot on the bookshelf?
Now, like with everything, I like to encourage parents to start from their list of common values, like their core family values. What do you care about at home? What do you want your child to learn from you? And then choose your books according to that. Do you want to encourage, you know, kindness, well-being, mindfulness? Bring stories and books about that, emotional intelligence, nature, you know, do you want your kids to be curious about nature and animals? Choose books about that. Now, up until age of six, I wouldn't recommend anything that is, fantasy. I'd recommend more real, stories about other kids, about animals. But then after the age of six, you can, you know, include fantasy for a child to read on their own. I say good because you can have a huge collection of hundreds of books, but then like you start reading a story and you're like, what is this even about? Why am I reading this? And then get rid of that book.
I have that where I'm like, if I feel like this is a book that I could have written myself easily. then we're not going to be returning to it. Lots of people getting in touch with their suggestions for what should be on your list as well. Although Sharon saying, let's talk Nerf guns with a sad face. Let's not talk Nerf guns, Sharon. Isabella saying, I had a toy guitar. Could musical instruments be on Pascal's list?
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
lots of you getting in touch with the toys you played with as a child. And I'd love to know if they've kind of informed your life and even your job. Pascal is with us. She's the founder of Moment of P. She went from a fast-paced life with Google to wanting a bit more balance at home, wanting some more time with the family at home, and wanting to help other parents improve their relationships with their children. She's trained in relationship coaching as well as mindfulness and well-being, and she's a certified professional co-active and parenting coach. We're talking about the toys you do need at home and the ones that you perhaps could definitely swerve. Britta saying, all my kids' toys are hand-me-downs, take good care of them, and then when they outgrow them, we give them to younger children. Never been comfortable buying my kids' toys. It does seem wasteful. I know they're going to lose interest in them eventually. Sally saying, I had a drawing board for chalk and marker, enjoyed drawing a lot and still do now as I've developed my art skills and have a collection of paintings. And Isabella saying, I had a toy guitar. So we've talked about messy play. So Sally there, art supplies, ding, ding, ding. What about a toy guitar? Personally, I can think of a few places I'd like to, you know, chuck a recorder out. But when it comes to sensory materials, whether that is messy stuff or even music, does that have a place on your list, Pascal?
That's exactly our next point, which is the sensory material. Now, a sensory material can be as simple as just water, rocks, some rice or dry beans. Some people like to do sensory, you know, play with food. All you need is just a container somewhere to, you know, contain it. And you can definitely say that musical instruments fall under this category. Now, again, it's not something you absolutely necessarily need, but it does fall under sensory if you choose to do so.
And last on your list is board games. What value do you think board games bring to the family? We've had some great times around the table playing a board game. They've also been the source of some pretty significant Spearman family dramas back before I was married. Why do you think they're a valuable addition to the home?
Yeah, well, they can cause drama, especially, you know, with little kids. But it's a chance for the family to sit together, also to teach social skills. You can teach the concept of winning, losing, taking turns, waiting for your turn. So I think it's a beautiful addition to your home. It can be as simple as a deck of cards or multiple options of board games.
So those are the toys that we should be incorporating into our families' lives. So what about the ones that we don't? Here's Helly. She is the woman behind the blog My Little Loves, and she talks about a certain doll brand on social media, and it got a lot of reaction. She now thinks these toys are very different to the toys we had in years gone by.
When you walk into a toy shop straight away, you know, the kids just get so excited by all the plastic colours and tack and, you know, all of that kind of stuff, whether it's, I feel like if we look back to what we had when we were younger, I suppose we were more, I don't know, there was less available. So we were more excited by smaller things. And I'm finding now that my children especially are seeing all the flashing lights and they're seeing all the things that are like squishing out goo or gunk, even back to that LOL dolls and things. You know, a lot of parents were like, yeah, but my kids so young, they don't really understand that yet. And, you know, thinking that maybe because I had put it out there that maybe my kids would know those things. And I'm like, no, they don't. But then equally, I don't want to have to answer those questions at such young ages, you know. So why does this little doll have fishnet, or why do they have like these crisscross tights on their legs? And we know as adults, they're fishnet stockings. And would we wear them? No, you know.
It is a really, really complicated one because we do have our kids, you know, we can have the best of intention when it comes to ad blockers or, you know, not watching TV, but they are going to be subjected to advertising, to peer pressure. But before we talk about how to say no, Pascal, I'd love your guidelines, just a quick run through, if you don't mind, of the toys that you feel don't really have a place in the home.
Yeah. So I'd start with everything that is broken or missing a piece. I mean, what's the point of keeping them if they don't work properly? Just get rid of them. Pass them along, sell them, recycle them, or just get rid of them. Anything that is ultra specific, you know, whatever cannot be imagined into something else or played with in multiple ways, whatever is super specific, I wouldn't get it. You know, that these are the toys that people grow out of and just leave after a couple of weeks. toys that play by themselves, you know, toys that light up, sing and dance and move and entertain themselves. And the children are just passive watching them. These are not doing any service to the child. They're not teaching the child anything. They're actually taking them away from the present moment and not letting them, you know, move and do something. So get rid of that. Anything that annoys you, after all, you live in that house. If you don't love it, don't keep it. If you're going to walk by it and get stressed every time, get rid of it. It does not belong in your home. Your home should be a sacred space of joy. So everything you own should fall into, you know, your list of values and what you love. Same way with anything ugly. You know, if you want your space to be beautiful and this is, you know, hurts your eyes, just give it away. Does not belong even in your storage space. It's just taking space for no reason. So basically declutter. Next would be anything that is an advertisement for a product. You know, if it's a swag from a company conference, no, you don't need it. TV character shows, again, these lead the kids to do repetitive play and be very rigid instead of coming up with their own ideas. So I would go back to as simple as possible. If you want a doll, let it be as simple as possible and let the kid add in from their imagination. Passing fads, you mentioned Tamagotchis at the end. If it's not built to last, why keep it? Why buy it? Why spend your money on it? And, you know, after all, if you think of sustainability, we're buying more plastic and then we're dumping more plastic. Just say no, skip. Duplicates. I mean, you don't need 10 fire trucks. You know, it's just clutter. Anything that you have in duplicates, you know, you can get rid of. Declutter your space. And finally, everything that is offensive in nature. If you feel it's offensive, it does not belong in your home. If it's genuinely like unkind or mean and that's what it leads to, it does not belong in your home.
Well, so those are the toys that Pascal believes do not have a place in your home. Agree or disagree? We are
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking toys now. Pascal is the founder of Moments of P, discussing the toys we should and indeed perhaps shouldn't have in our home for our children's development, our relationship with them, for education, learning, and of course, some fun as well. No name on this message, but I think it's a great, great question and comment saying, how about emotional values attached to some toys that kids don't want to let go of? How do you justify getting rid of toys to a child? A tricky one. I've tried a couple of different methods, sometimes with their consent and sometimes without. Pascal, well, what would you say when it comes to explaining to a child, especially when there is that emotional attachment?
I would say definitely start by validating their emotions. You know, just by saying, yep, I see you really, you know, are attached to this, or you really love this, or, you know, grandma gave it to you. And start by focusing on the value. Like, why don't you want them to have it? Communicate. Now, of course, if they're much, much younger and hiding it away for a few days will get them to get over it, then maybe that's easier. But when they're a bit older, validate, talk to them, acknowledge. I find explaining to my daughter might take a few days for her to be okay with, you know, giving something away. We've had some dolls that I really don't want in my house given to her on her birthday, I think. And we kept them for a while in a box hidden. And after a few months, I asked her, hey, how about we declutter and we do a garage sale and all the money that you get from this, you get to buy something else. And suddenly she was like, okay, we can do that. So give them some, you know, responsibility. Put yourself in their shoes. If it was me and if this was something I'm emotionally attached to, what would I like to hear? Would I be okay giving it away? Maybe they're looking for a sense of security, a sense of, you know, a reminder of someone. Maybe we can replace it with something else. And to avoid it in the long term, I would say don't be shy to communicate to your friends and to family when there's gifts to be given. that this is what you want and this is what you don't want. It made a huge difference in our life.
We've got a party this weekend for a friend's little girl. So as soon as the invitation came back, I was like, right, what is okay? What is not okay? My husband's like, we're going to bring a big bag of glitter and a recorder if you don't tell us what. Because, you know, we all know as parents what we want our kids to be playing with. We also know what resonates with them in that moment. They might have already, I think it's absolutely fine to ask what to bring, you know, as a gift and perhaps to say as a parent what you'd rather have. We had one year where we just said, we know we've got enough toys. We'd love a copy of your child's favourite book. And then it's something personal as well. I think that maybe a moment of discomfort can be worth a headache of decluttering and difficult conversations. But to go back a step, a question from Leah saying, how can you say no to a child who won't stop asking for a specific toy? I think a lot will depend on the age of the child, I'm sure, Pascal. But what would be your general advice there?
Now, remember, number one, you are in control. If you don't let them asking trigger you and make you uncomfortable and stressed, you will be able to deal with this better. Keep yourself calm, focus on yourself. And in that moment, focus on understanding. And like I said, validating, like, I know you really want this toy. Let's talk about it. Why do you want this toy? If it's something your friend has, then maybe when you visit your friends, you can play with them there. And explain to them, why do you think it does not sit well with your values? And why do you not want to get that toy? What would you suggest to replace it with? And it's a long game, all right? It's not something like a fix that you can do with, you know, one sentence and it's done. It's a way, think of it of a way that we are preparing our kids. And in time, you will notice that it will become easier and easier. Again, avoid the source of the drama. So if your kid is watching a lot of ads on YouTube or a lot of, you know, unpacking, opening of new toys, maybe we should stop that. So take things back a step.
It's been really interesting to hear your thoughts this afternoon, Pascal, and also to get messages from people about what they played with growing up and some of the challenges that we have as parents when it comes to toys. Elisa got in touch on 0487155500. She had a favourite toy.
I grew up in the Soviet Union. At least we stayed there up until I was 4 years old. So I'm Russian, born in Kazakhstan, and we'd only have access to Western-made toys or chocolate or candy every 2 weeks. So for me, it was Kinder Surprise that really stood out. To date, I still run around buying them and collecting the toys, and I like doing the whole building part.
And I think that's exactly it. You know, a lot of it comes back to memories and spending time with the kids, Pascal. For anyone who wants a bit more information about what you do, we didn't have a chance today to talk about displaying and rotating toys and the benefits of that, which we can touch on a future show for sure. What's the best way of contacting you about workshops?
Instagram, Moment of Parenting. You can find me there. On my website, it's momentofp.com. You can find everything there. I really hope people will reach out, and I'm happy to help with any questions.
Well, you've definitely saved us some money and hopefully some space this afternoon. So really, really appreciate it. Pascal there speaking to us from Moments of Parenting.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is Sunday and asking you this afternoon, yes you, do you know how to perform CPR? After a really sad and very shocking incident when the Euros kicked off over the weekend, we saw Denmark's Christian Eriksen collapsing 40 minutes into the game with Finland. His captain performed CPR, cleared his airways, and his teammates ran to shield him from millions of TV viewers. A team of doctors resuscitated him. He's now recovering in hospital. So if it happened to someone and you're around, would you know what to do? Rebecca Smith is joining us from Safe Hands. Rebecca, what was your reaction upon seeing the news and reading about it today?
It was actually my husband that ran into the room last night and he said, you'll never guess what's happening. Someone's collapsed in the football. They're performing CPR. And I think it just shocked everybody that was watching. You know, we're all aware that these things can happen. And maybe we know of someone who suffered cardiac arrest or had a similar incident. But when you sort of visibly see it and when it's that close to home, it's a shock to the system. And it definitely was for me last night, like I say, watching that live on TV, like I'm sure it was for, you know, thousands, millions of people even, yeah.
I think the positive to come out of it is that it was so shocking and it was on such a global stage that people realised mm-hmm. that basic first aid, even when you've got a crew of medics and you've got the world watching, to be able to do something mm-hmm. in that moment, is mm-hmm. it can literally be the difference between life or death. You know, these incidents happen all around the world, and whether or not someone survives can depend on the first aid skills of those around them. Do we have any stats, Rebecca, about how many people here actually know how to perform CPR?
So I can give you some stats sort of globally, but around 54% of people say that they've done some form of CPR training or first aid training in the past. It's an okay stat. It's not great. But what I would also go on to question is, how competent do you feel in actually performing those skills? And and when was your last refresher? Because these skills are something that you don't anticipate or hope to ever have to use. And, you know, these incidents, luckily, are few and far between. But to give yourself the best chance of feeling confident and competent in that situation and actually being able to react with your instincts and jump in, you know, you have to keep those skills up to date. So 54% of people in general say they've done some sort of CPR or first aid training. But like I say, I would question sort of when was the last time you did your course, and how comfortable would you feel if you were in that situation today?
I'm looking pretty sheepish over here in the studio because I did a course when my youngest was, well, no, when I was pregnant with her. So that would be four and a half, five years ago. And I would count myself as someone who's done a course, but I don't know in the moment if I would feel confident about delivering those things. I just don't think I would. And when it comes to CPR, as I said, it can really depend life and death on what happens in the seconds after that incident happens. Do we have any data mm-hmm. around survival rates with and without CPR?
So they say in general, CPR can double and in some cases triple a person's chances of survival. Those survival sort of chances increase again with defibrillation, which is when you get a defibrillator to pass an electrical current through the heart. So the knowledge of first aid and how to perform these sort of basic life-saving skills, and knowing if you have, you know, access to this sort of equipment in terms of defibrillators is really, really crucial in these sorts of situations. And there's another statistic about heart attacks and cardiac arrest and, you know, collapse. And 4 out of 5 sort of cardiac arrests do happen at home or outside of a hospital setting.
There's no argument. We need to have this knowledge, we need to have this information. But can you talk us through what we would do in the event that, you know, God forbid it happens to a loved one, for example?
We follow a 5-step process in any sort of emergency. The first thing you have to do before you sort of jump in with these sorts of skills is establish that it is actually a life-threatening situation. You know, you don't want to be jumping in and performing compressions or CPR on someone who's maybe just sort of heavily asleep. So there's a process we have to follow. It's a 5-step process. The first step is to check for safety. When we talk about safety, we talk about surroundings and we talk about your personal safety. So in terms of, do you know the person? What's your relationship to that person? Do you need a first aid kit or any protective equipment as well? After we've done that, we're going to approach the person and we're going to check for response. So we're going to check to see whether they're conscious or unconscious. So giving them a tap, so stimulation by touch, tap on the shoulder, asking the person to squeeze your hand, and just seeing where they're at in terms of their consciousness level. The next thing you need to do following response, if you don't get one, is call an ambulance. So out here, the number that we'd need to dial is 999 generically for emergency services, 998 specifically if you want to go through to the ambulance centre out here, but either of those will work. Once we've done that, we then need to establish whether or not the person is breathing. And this is where the sort of life-threatening versus non-life-threatening situation comes into play and is established. The way we check for breathing is a look, listen and feel technique. Ideally, you want to have the person positioned on their back and you want to place your cheek towards the person's mouth whilst placing your hand on their chest and looking for evidence of breathing, listening for it and feeling for it as well. Do that for 10 seconds. If no breathing is present, we want to jump straight in with our CPR, okay? CPR is cardiopulmonary resuscitation. And the first thing we do is place 2 hands on the sternum right in the center of the chest. And we push down to a depth of about 2.5-3 inches in an adult. We then let the chest fully rebound and continue that for 30 times, essentially, 30 compressions. If it's a loved one and you feel comfortable doing this, I know we're in a pandemic at the moment, might not be as relevant outside of the situation if it being a loved one or sort of close family member or friend, but we can then go ahead and give mouth-to-mouth resuscitation following those 30 compressions, which is when you seal the nose, tilt the head back, and breathe into the mouth twice. You then continue that cycle of 30 compressions to 2 rescue breaths until the ambulance reaches you or the person starts to respond, so they start to breathe on their own again.
Rebecca, I can only imagine, I'm sure lots of people taking notes this afternoon and, you know, obviously forward this podcast on to anyone if you aren't able to. And I know you had an awful lot of queries, understandably, about CPR after last night. What do people need to know about coming in for a full course certification and really getting confidence in the skills that they need?
So we really, really do advise that you come in for a full day training course. We cover everything with regards to CPR and the core skills involved in first aid, but also the non-life-threatening emergencies as well. We focus on theoretical learning, and we also focus on practical learning, so you're actually trying the skills out as well. As a little taster, we are hosting a webinar tomorrow evening at 7:30, just to cover CPR as a skill in the 5-step process. Just so that, God forbid, should anything like that happen, at least you have some knowledge in terms of a reaction to that situation.
Rebecca, I think you're absolutely right. Whether it's parents, nannies, colleagues, school staff, you know, these are people we spend our time with. Our kids are with them as well. So this is tomorrow night. Where can people find out more information? As I said, it's from Safe Hands, but is it a website sign up? What's the best way of confirming a spot?
We're going to be posting it on our social media, and we'll post a link to the sign up on there. So if you follow us at Safe Hands UAE on Instagram, you will be seeing that go up very, very shortly.
Brilliant. Rebecca Smith, thank you so much. And we have heard that Christian Eriksen, who did collapse 40 minutes into the game last night, is he sent a WhatsApp to his teammate saying he's doing good. And I'm sure, big, big thank you to his captain and the medics as well. Thank you so much.
No problem at all. Thank you, Helen.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Great to have you with us on this Sunday afternoon as we talk children's health, parenting and education too. And I don't know about you, but many of us have affirmations around the house for ourselves. It might be a post-it note on the mirror. We've seen parents putting little notes into their lunchboxes. But what are the impact of powerful, positive words to our children? There's been discussions around improving health, managing stress, overcome challenges and helping you make better choices. So positive thinking can often start with positive self-talk. And where our children's self-talk can come from is often us as parents. We're joined now by Linda Fussell. She is the head of lower school at Dwight School here in Dubai to talk about some of the affirmations, the words and sentences that we can use with our children, specifically around this really challenging time of, yes, continued uncertainty. Linda, thank you so much for being with us today. And I feel like affirmations are something that might have kind of crept into public consciousness in the last, say, 5 to 10 years. But it was always felt a bit out there, a bit woo-woo. And now, as I said, they're going mainstream, and for good reason. Can you tell us about some of the benefits that you have felt yourself, either as a grown-up or that you've seen with children as well?
Sure. Thank you. Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be here, Helen. Affirmations and positive feedback and authentic praise, scientifically, they do release dopamine in the brain, and it feels good. And so when you do say something to a child, your words can have a positive effect or a negative effect or no effect. And obviously, the goal is to have a positive effect. So I think we're going to talk a little bit about what you as parents can say and what you should say to extend that for your child.
For anyone that's not even familiar with the phrase an affirmation, can you explain what it is and what form it can take?
So, yes, it is a statement or a phrase that helps to affirm something that a child is feeling. And you can, with your affirmation, you can hurt harm or help your child, and you really want to help your child grow from every interaction. And so when a child says something, if you have the right response that helps your child grow, then you're on to something. And that's the goal. It is not about your child making you feel good. It is about you helping your child to feel good about himself or herself, so they can develop a growth mindset.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, we keep on coming back to this phrase around growth mindset or even resilience, and especially during the course of the pandemic. And I think what's really important to address when we think about resilience or growth mindset is it sounds very formal and it can sound a bit cold. And it sounds like, you know, resilience means that children are unfeeling and uncaring and, you know, bounce back. And that's not the case at all. What kind of resilience do you feel like is actually a really positive way of moving through the world?
That is such an excellent point. And I'm glad you brought that up, Helen, because sometimes when you say, oh, my child is so resilient in front of your child, or you need to show some grit or have some resilience, it also can mean you just get on with it, get over it, mm-hmm. and just keep going. And sometimes they don't need to hear that. Sometimes what they need is for you to affirm, I'm sad right now. I see that you're sad. How can I help you? Why are you feeling sad? What do you think that we can do as next steps to help get over the sadness? It's okay to feel what they feel, and you have to help them sometimes get there. And if you talk about resilience without unpacking it, sometimes it can be felt as if you are telling someone to just pull up your bootstraps, get on with it, don't feel anything.
Stiff upper lip, to quote my fellow countrymen. Good. And I think that's especially important right now when we think about raising boys and, you know, it being okay to cry and ask for help and show what you might perceive to be a weakness. And, you know, when we're thinking about affirmations, what we're really doing is hopefully switching some of that negative self-talk, you know, building some strong just good kind of sense of identity, but also even changing the brain. You know, that's the power that some of this positive self-talk can have. And I think for me, you can just feel a bit silly doing it. I think, you know, I always think about back to Friends, where Chandler was playing that tape about, you know, trying to give up smoking, being, I'm a strong, confident woman. And I'm not someone that's going to look in the mirror with a post-it note and saying, I'm a strong, confident woman. But I think there are some affirmations that can feel more natural or indeed unnatural than others. So if it does feel a bit cringe, you might just be a case of just not finding the right words or the right phrasing that actually resonates with you and could make a difference to your day-to-day life or that of your child. You've got a lovely list, Linda, of some phrases, some words that you think would be nice to weave into our daily talk. And I certainly don't want anyone to think, right, this is what you're going to do at 5 o'clock tonight. You're going to sit down with your child at the table and you're going to hold their hands and look into their eyes and go, now it's time to do our affirmations and make it weird. We don't want anyone's children to be like, Mum and Dad have got really strange and they're saying these words to me and it's come from nowhere. How can you if this is something that the family hasn't done traditionally?
Oh, that's funny. So this is, I'll give you a little backstory on this. There's a graphic floating around on the internet, and it's a beautiful graphic, and it says nine nice things to say to your kid every day. So as educators, we, you know, we read these things and, you know, we might chuckle a little bit because we want to push our parents to say these with intentionality and to understand the why. Because sometimes we as parents, I'm a parent as well, you know, I say something and if I don't understand the why, then it rings hollow. Do you know what I mean? And shallow. So these nine things that you can say to your kid every day, we would actually push on a little of them and ask parents to kind of unpack it a little bit more.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
If you're into your affirmations, you might have a mirror covered in post-it notes. Maybe you talk to yourself, maybe you journal them. But what about affirmations for your kids? They show they can really make a difference because we know that parent talk becomes self-taught. Linda Fussell is with us, the head of lower school at Dwight School Dubai, revealing the nine affirmations you should be saying to your child. And she's starting with the most important one.
Obviously, I love you. You can say it how many times? 1,000, 1,000,000, as many as you want, whether your child is one or 99. But also say why. give reasons why. It is really important for children to understand these are the attributes and the things that just make you so unique and special and such an important member of our family. The second one is, I like it when you... ...
And here's where, yeah. I'm like, I like it when you stay in your bed past 6 o'clock.
So here's where we would add the twist. Say what it is that you like, but it also, and number four, I'm proud of you. When you say I like, or I love, or I'm proud, it becomes about you. So we add this little twist. It shouldn't be about you. Twist it to say, you should be very proud of yourself because X, Y, Z. Or, wow, did you like that? Did you like it when you do that? Make it into a question for your child, because you, and as educators, we are very cautious in the classroom that we don't sit there and say constantly, I'm so proud of you, because then children will look for that and it's like keeping score. They want to keep score. So we would encourage people to say, you really should be proud of the amount of effort that you put into that drawing. Mm-hmm. Or wow is a great affirmation. Just wow, look what you did. How did you think about that? That's why I say add a little bit more depth and intentionality when you're saying these nine things. So number two is, I like it when you. Number three is, you make me happy. And we would add, what makes you happy? Ask your child, what makes you happy? And very few of us with our five-year-old would ask, well, what makes you happy? That makes me happy, but what makes you happy? Can you imagine the conversation that would flow? Mm-hmm. And so number four is, I'm proud of you, and I already talked about that one. It's not about making us proud as the adults. It's about how you should be proud of the effort and the abilities that you put into that. Number five, you are special. And here's why. This is why you're special and unique. If you keep telling children they're special, it loses its meaning because they don't understand, well, why am I special? What does that even mean?
There's losing meaning, and then there's raising a generation of kids who've just been told they're special and magical. Exactly. And these gorgeous little unicorns who can do no wrong. And I don't think anyone wants to be a parent to that horror show. So
Exactly. So we call that empty praise. Mm-hmm. And empty praise, it actually gives a child a momentary glow of a feel good, and then it dissipates. Think about your boss, Helen. If your boss says, oh, I'm so proud, that was so good, versus, you should be really proud, Helen. You really nailed that. Here's why. It just lands differently when you have authenticity behind it, and then you talk about the why. So number six is, I trust you.
Oh, wow.
And we always, I trust you. And the reason that this is important is because if you unpack it and you say to a child, you're being very principled, here's why. Being principled is what you do when no one is watching. Imagine how important that is versus, I trust you and it's all about making you give me your trust. No, share it differently. Share it to the point where they understand nobody's around. This is how you behave because you are principled. And isn't that beautiful?
Mm-hmm. Sorry, this is so interesting for my kids at the moment, because I think a lot of children will try and get away with what they can. And what I love the idea of is raising these, again, like, I want them to have some fun and to make some mistakes, but I also want them to ultimately do the right thing and feel uncomfortable when they don't. So yesterday we had an incident where my daughter had done something and kept it secret, and I'd found out and we'd spoken about it, and I'm not going to say what it was, but there was a consequence. And afterwards she said to me, she was like, Mummy, I feel so much better now that I've told you my secret. I felt really unhappy and sad. Mm. And I was like, oh, wow. And it was interesting, because as soon as she told me and when we did something about it, we addressed it, she was like a different child. In the morning, she was really withdrawn, quite grumpy, quite snappy. Mm-hmm. And then the afternoon, she was like, la la, chat, 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 back to her normal self. While she didn't do the right thing initially, she clearly had this feeling gnawing away at her to the point where she had to say something, and she was almost relieved that she'd got in trouble and there was a consequence.
It's... That's an absolutely important process for a child to go through. And I can just warn all parents everywhere across Dubai and the UAE and the globe, this will happen. Your child will keep something from you, and you will have to decide, how are you going to respond? Will you react or will you respond? And if you respond, you will teach your child and model for your child how you handle situations that make you feel not great. Mm-hmm. And you demonstrated to her, this is why you tell mommy, and this is the reason why, and I can help you. I'm your advocate and I can help you. And that's why she felt better, because she got it off of her chest.
I know. And bless her. In honesty, I was absolutely furious, but I'm trying really hard. And I think a lot of parents are hopefully the same, that I want my kids to be able to come and talk to me about anything at any point. And I think when they're little, you know, there's this quote which was, you know, you got to listen to little things when they're little, because these are the big things, you know, to them. And I want her to be able to come to me with the big things, you know, when she's a teenager or beyond, because I think that's where the communication can often fall down, and you get these rifts in relationships. And don't get me wrong, I don't want to be a best friend. I'm a bit suspicious of parents who are best friends with their kids. We've got friends. I just want her to be able to come to me, you know, should she need to, especially when we're living, you know, far from home. And
exactly.
When it comes to these affirmations, when is the right time to start doing them? I'm just aware that there could be parents of teens listening this afternoon who'd be like, my kid is going to roll their eyes till they're falling out of their head, because we haven't done this before. Presumably, you know, that kind of younger age, you know, start weaving them in. But are there any kind of older children phrases or terminologies or ways of delivering this love through words that wouldn't make them, you know, want to run in opposite direction?
It's never too late to start. And I do this with my 29-year-old and my 31-year-old. It's never too late. And by this time, if you've done it, I've been an educator for 23 years. If you've done it for so long, it's really organic and very authentic. It's more natural. It'll feel stilted at first, but you'll get into the routine of it, and you'll find your voice, and you'll find what works for your family and your dynamic. But I will caution parents, all children are different, and you might have three children growing up in the same household, and one will tell you everything and overshare, one will tell you nothing and never share, and one might be kind of hit or miss depending on the situation. And for those children, you can't force it. It has to be organic, but you can still say it. Believe me, they're listening to every word you say. And they might be closed off and shut down, but by you saying it and meaning it, it is, I promise you, it is sinking in, because you're modeling for them. So yeah, kids are different, and it'll land differently, but you try, and you just make sure, number one is always the best one, make sure they know that you love them.
We just want our kids to feel loved, especially during this time of uncertainty. So a really important topic. Thank you so, so much.
You're quite welcome. Absolutely. Thank you.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You can tune in to Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer, live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to this podcast. It helps other people find us, boost us in the ratings, and you'll get it direct to your phone.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.